The Local Flavor Live podcast is powered by AudioStack, which provides all the tools you need to host, distribute, and monetize your podcast.
Welcome to Local Flavor Live, a podcast about the food and drink scene in Baltimore. I'm your host, Lauren Cohen, and I'm back today with our food and dining editor, Jane Marion. Hey,
yeah.
Jane.
Yo, LC. I'm not even waiting for you to say hi.
You're coming in with your line. I love it. How's it going?
Good. I know you had a big night last night.
Tell me about it. I saw Hamilton last night.
And?
It was incredible. Literally the only thing I can say is that it 100% lives up to all of the hype it's ever gotten.
Did you know the music?
I had listened to the music, but also I use this workout app when I'm at the gym, and I found this workout that had a Hamilton playlist.
Oh,
so I've been doing that over and over again, and I've really been getting it. And you know what? It's funny. Like, you don't think that musical would kind of like be
not that right.
Yeah. But it's great. And
well, it has a lot of beats. It has a lot of rhythm.
Yes.
So maybe for running, why are you running?
Yeah, it's an elliptical playlist.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's easy to like find the beat, and I had become familiar with some of the songs that way, and you know, of course, just being a human being that doesn't live under a rock, I've heard
so
some.
Jealous.
Oh, it was so great. It was an awesome opportunity. Our research editor Christine, who covers all of our arts and theater news, invited me to be her plus one. I felt very undeserving of it.
That is the best work perk I've ever heard of.
It's so cool. Yeah. It's funny. So I studied acting for 4 years in high school. We've talked about
that
this.
About you.
Yeah. I went to Carver Center for Arts and Technology in Towson. And I really did love like more of the script analysis part of the program. I realized pretty early on that I wasn't going to be, you know, pursuing theater beyond high school, and I think Carver is a great way to kind of find that out about yourself.
For sure.
But
I mean, we were kind of shy.
You're
one of those shy people that maybe came to life on stage.
Yes, I really enjoyed it in that respect. It was a good way to kind of grow as a person and in my personality. But I never liked musicals. I really didn't like. I was around
it wasn't theater.
I don't know. Uh-huh. I really like. I was around all of these like quote unquote theater kids. Who just like sang Rent in their sleep,
annoying,
you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was that. I mean, they're all lovely people, but I don't know if it was that kind of turned me off, or I just was never connected. I've always loved music, but you know, it just wasn't. It's never been my favorite thing. And you know, going to Hamilton though, it's just a completely different vibe and a different experience. And
who was the lead? Do you know?
Oh,
is that somebody famous?
Not in the, well, I mean, maybe famous in the Broadway world,
right,
which I'm not
sure.
Super connected to, but it wasn't somebody
who I
recognized.
Yeah.
No. But they were, all of the performers on the national tour are so talented.
Yeah, I always think, I mean, it's great to go, the idea of going to a show in New York is always such a great thing.
Yeah.
But no matter what, if, you know, it's two people, it can be like $1,000 day. If
right.
If you wait in line for tickets at TKTS,
right.
You know, you might not be seeing a show that you want, and sometimes you're nicely surprised, and sometimes it was an expensive mistake.
Right.
But I think coming, you know, those repertory shows that come through are really just as good. I saw Hamilton in Chicago.
How was it in Chicago?
I mean, it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up outside of New York City, so I grew up going to lots of shows.
Yeah.
But it was definitely up there with theater experiences. I did not know the music.
Okay.
And so it's, you know, you really do need to know the music. So I think at some point, you know, it just goes so rapid fire that you just have to accept that you might not get every single word or every single plot line.
I totally felt
that. Once you kind of let go of that, and it's a great experience.
Yeah. And what's interesting is I had listened to some of the music, but then, you know, when you're listening to it, it's all out of context. I knew nothing about the plot or really a lot about his life, frankly. So, you know, I had heard these things, but really piecing them together and seeing how they played out on stage was incredible.
Yeah. And I love that, you know, the writer Lin-Manuel Miranda performed it for the first time at the White House.
Wow.
Did, I don't know if you know that.
No, fun fact.
Yeah, it was in the Michelle Obama book, Becoming.
Oh, that's right, your favorite
but
book.
But it is kind of a known fact that I didn't know either.
Yeah.
But he was, I guess it was like a night of performances, and he debuted it there, and Michelle Obama said, like, she thought it sounded really strange, you know, concept.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And she and Barack just loved it. So that was the first place. I'm sure there's footage of that somewhere on YouTube. You can look it up.
Oh, he is a genius. He truly is. It's such a great experience. There actually still are tickets available. I think
really?
That the run at the Hippodrome is
I'm
4
shocked.
Weeks. Yeah. They're doing this lottery program, and, you know, so there are ways if people are still excited
okay.
to see it.
Are you going to be a theater critic now?
I don't know. I have so much respect for it. I think that, you know, Broadway and musicals, it was just never something that I personally connected with, but I have so much respect for the craft and, you know, really enjoyed my time learning about it and dissecting scripts and things like that.
I'll have to see my next play with you.
I would love that.
What's going on in food?
In the food world, switching tracks completely.
Back to reality.
Yes,
food.
Exactly. So great openings this week. We saw that the Tilted Row, this is one that's been kind of anticipated, especially in the Bolton Hill community. It's finally open. This is another restaurant from Ziad Malouf, who is the owner of Cafe Philly, which we love, in Mount Vernon. So it's a new spot. It's really adding to this great momentum that Bolton Hill has right now. We saw Nuna's opened and also Cookhouse, which is from the same owners of On the Hill Cafe, is expected to open this fall. So really great dining options in that area. There's a chef, his name is Andrew Thomas. He was previously at Donna's and The Elephant, both now closed.
Officially.
Closed. Yes,
yeah.
The Elephant has officially closed.
We're
for
not
anybody
happy
wondering.
About it. It's just we keep reporting that it closed, then it opened, but now it's really closed.
Exactly, that roller coaster. But anyway, we're happy to report that the chef is now settled. He's at Tilted Row, and he's really serving up some great elevated bar dishes. So things like crab deviled eggs with an Old Bay mousse. And then as far as main plates, cast iron crab cakes with succotash and roasted asparagus with a sorghum brined pork chop. I mean, everything sounds really great. There's some other worldly dishes like lamb ribs with smoked tzatziki.
Over the map. I'm not surprised you worked at the Elephant.
Yeah.
Honestly, I hate to say it. I've said it before. When a menu tries to do too many
things
and visit too many countries, it can really be problematic as a chef.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You don't want to spread yourself too thin.
I hope they find their way. I mean, it's cool to have something that appeals to everybody, but that's just a few too many places and countries to...
Yeah, I'm interested to try it. I really am interested to get in there. The space itself looks absolutely stunning. It's, you know, there's a lot of woods. There's also these beautiful pops of navy and gold and bronze. So it really is a beautiful space. It's on the bottom floor of the Jordan apartment building.
Hmm.
So officially open, excited to get in there and, you know, wish them the best of luck.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when people just pop into that neighborhood, it really is a great little neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure the residents who live there really want places to eat. But also when you go for a night at the Meyerhof or to the Lyric, it's nice to have options.
Yes.
So.
For sure.
That's good news.
Yeah, definitely. And over in Pigtown, we saw the opening of this place called Honey's Cafe. It looks so sweet and inviting. Really, you know, the type of cafe that Pigtown really thrives on and loves.
Such a cute neighborhood.
It is. There are so many great local businesses there. I know that the Main Street Association that they have there is really tight-knit. And
yeah, it's really strong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Honey's Cafe just opened. It's the former home of Cafe Jovial, which people loved. I think that was around for like 10 years or even more. So it's really cozy, lots of natural light in there, very bright, as the name kind of entails, and open for breakfast and lunch, so you can get things like red velvet waffles, French toast topped with fried apples, shrimp and grits, steak and eggs, and of course there's a lengthy coffee menu, everything from dirty chais to tuxedo mochas, black and white mochas. So it seems like just a really great go-to spot in the neighborhood for families and people who want to set up a laptop and work for the day.
Yeah.
So happy to report that. And we had some news from Magdalena this week, which is awesome. I know you and I dined at Magdalena together not too long ago. It's so beautiful.
It was a long time ago, believe it or not. I think it was
November. It's in the winter. Yes, that's right. It seems like it really does. So Chef Mark Levy, who is he's from England, he recently opened the restaurant on Sundays. Historically, it has never been open on Sundays.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so he opened it to launch this new Sunday supper program, which is really a nod to his upbringing in the UK. You know, Sunday supper there is a huge tradition where people gather with families either in a home or at a local pub. So he has kind of taken that nostalgia that he has for that tradition and turned it into a menu that has kind of elevated spins on UK fare. So things like fish and chips with pea puree and tartar sauce, English pea ravioli with wild mushrooms, and crispy duck leg confit with house-made tater tots. So it sounds like it's really beautiful, and it has a story to it, which is awesome.
I like the story. I lived in London for an entire year, actually.
You did?
I didn't eat any of this stuff.
Really?
I was a starving student.
What did you eat when you were there?
Of Sunday supper.
What did you eat?
Lots of fish and chips.
Yeah. Did you hang out in pubs a lot?
I did. Uh-huh. I learned to like hard cider.
Oh, yes.
Mom, hope you're not listening. I really learned to like cheese. I always liked cheese, but I really learned, like, you know, some of those really wonderful cheddars. And there's a cheese, I think it's called Kaffir Lily or something along those lines that has, or Cotswold cheese, which has both cheddar and blue cheese sort of sandwiched in between the cheddar. It's just delicious. Wow. I hung out in Neil's Yard where the famous cheddar is from.
Wow.
I ate a lot of scones. I was very big on carbs that year. But traditionally, England was not a place known for its fine cuisine, honestly.
Yeah.
I learned to like Indian food. I think I ate Indian food there for the first time. This is a very large Indian population in London.
That's so
interesting. They have some really famous Indian restaurants. I didn't eat at the famous ones because they were expensive, but I ate at the less expensive
You were balling
ones.
On a budget,
yeah,
for sure.
So.
But this sounds great. I think it's a great way to kind of connect people to the chef's story through his cooking. And
I mean, the place is really special. I see it's $58.
Yeah, so there's an option to do a three-course menu for $58, or there's also an a la carte menu of his like UK spins as well.
Yeah, I mean, $58 is still steep for a meal, but it's cheap for a meal there,
right? No, that makes sense.
So it's a good gateway meal.
Yeah,
that's
right.
What I would say.
Yeah, so a great new offering from Magdalena, and unfortunately, we did see a closing this week. This is a sad one. So Blue Dog Barbecue Company, which opened—I mean, I don't think it's even been a year yet—in October.
Mm-hmm.
They were struggling. I mean, the way that I phrased it in my blog this week was that the cards were totally stacked against them when they opened. I remember I interviewed the co-owner, Michael Neal, for a story that I wrote about construction and how it's been impacting businesses.
In Harbor East.
Yes, specifically in Harbor East. And so he said that I think it was 5 days before their opening, the city started doing this huge infrastructure overhaul where they were digging up streets, and it was awful. And, you know, the kind of ironic part is that they ran the walk score for that restaurant before they opened, and it was like the best walk score than they possibly could.
What's a walk score?
I think it's just like a numeric, a way to gauge how walkable the area
is
around
there. That's really
interesting,
yeah. Yeah. That is important to look at, you know, accessibility,
when you're opening a restaurant,
obviously.
Sure. And it was like the best, you know, that they could find, and they had been scouting locations, and it's really sad they ended up closing because of, you know, everything that's been going on in that area construction-wise. This was recent, I think it was within the last week that they put a sign on their door saying that, you know, they were closed indefinitely. So
yeah, you know, it goes to show you, I mean, a lot of restaurants, you know, it can be really arbitrary as to why they don't work.
Right.
It could be a bad location.
Mm-hmm.
It could be just bad service, you know, that they can't find the right chef, or any number of factors. And this is just something that nobody, you know, is sort of no reflection on them and no reflection on whatever they were serving. But it's just sad.
It is.
Bad luck.
Yeah.
Are they thinking about opening somewhere else?
I really hope so. I think mm-hmm. that, I mean, they had an amazing business model. All of their wood, all of their meats were smoked on site in a smoker that they had in their adjacent courtyard in that building. Mm-hmm. It's the old tank building where Heavy Seas Ale House used yes. to be. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's amazing. They were smoking everything on site and using this unique method. They had done like local barbecue festivals in the area mm-hmm. and people just like loved their stuff.
So we'll see them again.
I hope so.
It's a shame because the dust is literally finally starting to settle in yeah. the Harbor East. And working here, we've seen just dramatic changes.
Yeah.
I've been in Harbor East for 20 years on and off mm-hmm. and there was literally nothing here. I think Blue Moon Cafe was the only place you could really walk to and eat.
Yeah.
We were thrilled to get the Whole Foods. That was such a big deal. Now we're kind of sick of we're over the salad bar just because we eat it every single day.
And it's moving. They're moving the Whole Foods even closer to us.
But this is really a hub. I mean, I know a lot of people flock to Harbor East to eat. People come from the county to eat and shop here. And it's really taking off. Maybe they were just like a year too soon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely unfortunate timing and, you know, really hoping that we see them again in some form, yes. some iteration, a pop-up, a presence at a festival, anything. So that was pretty sad. And, you know, other sad news that I reported earlier this week was the one-year anniversary. Well, the one-year anniversary of Anthony Bourdain's death was earlier this month, but for his birthday, which fell on June 25th, Eric Ripert and Jose Andres declared his birthday to be Bourdain Day.
I love that.
Wasn't that so sweet?
So much love.
It is. It's definitely still so sad because his death is, you know, still so raw for so many people.
It's still shocking.
Yeah.
I was a huge fan.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday nights, I watched Parts Unknown pretty religiously.
Yeah.
And they kept billing, like, new episodes, even after his death in this really salacious way.
Yeah.
And that really turned me off.
Yeah.
Because they were just using it as kind of like a marketing hype.
Right, exactly. It seems like it's in poor taste.
Yeah. I just read his book, Kitchen Confidential, last year for a story I was reporting.
Yes,
actually.
Incredible story.
But were you a fan?
I was. Yeah, I definitely, you know, I feel like there are so many people in the food world that were definitely a lot closer to his work. I would always catch it when it was on. Mm-hmm. But I think that I have gained such a greater appreciation for him and what he did, you know, just having learned more about what his philosophies were since his death. And I thought it was really beautiful that they paid tribute to him. So they, you know, basically they went on social media and they were like, anybody, no matter where you are in the world, no matter who you're with, raise a glass to him, toast to him, you know, do something in order to acknowledge, you know, the legacy that he left behind. And in Baltimore, it was really beautiful. We had some people who really, you know, took that challenge. And mm-hmm. Among them was Jerry Trice at Gunther & Co., who, yeah, he's wonderful. He devised this entire menu that was inspired by some of his favorite episodes of Parts Unknown and No Reservations.
What a cool idea.
He's great. He really, you know, I got a chance to talk with him for the story that I wrote, and he, you know, really took those philosophies. He calls him Tony. Everybody calls him Tony,
yeah.
I think.
Did he know him?
He said he knew people who knew him.
Yeah. Anyone who knew him,
which isn't surprising.
Called him Tony.
Right, exactly. But he just really had a lot to say about his philosophies on travelers versus tourists. And, you know, a traveler is not going to stay in the hotel for dinner. You're
right.
going to go out. You're going to meet the people
yeah.
who are cooking the food that is native to the place that you are. So he really, you know, took that ball and ran with it. His menu included things like steak frites and a chicken yakitori dish with chilled noodles and pork broth. And he had this bone marrow topped baguette with a salad of shaved shallots and lemon mm-hmm. juice. And then these lamb barbacoa tacos that he was really excited about. And he served them with Tecate beer with lime chilled.
Yeah, see, he's the chef, I would say, is probably an exception. You just mentioned like four different countries.
Right, exactly.
Now, but Jerry, having eaten there and knowing him and his background, he can do all those things.
Right.
He can go from Mexico to Tokyo to Thailand.
Yes, he's very talented. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a beautiful tribute. And something else that I thought was really interesting, the Maryland Food Bank, whose facility is in Halethorpe, on Bourdain Day, they had this community event where they hosted a conversation about how Anthony Bourdain's philosophies kind of connected to their mission of eradicating hunger. So, you know, people gathered and they talked and they shared, you know, their thoughts about that. Anthony Bourdain obviously had this huge philanthropic side to him as well. And then they had dinner, which was prepared by chefs in their Food Works program. This is the program that has young cooks in the kitchen. They teach them about, you know, sourcing local and things like that, but also it prepares them to enter the workforce.
Students in need or at risk.
So that's beautiful. And then at the end of the event, they had people sorting food on their conveyor belt.
This is really great. Yeah. Is this going to be a national thing or annual thing?
I hope so. I really do. I think that this is something that, you know, to Jose Andres and Eric Repair's credit, they really just they made it something. And, you know, it says a lot about the power of social media and how word spread. Yes. And so I really hope it continues. Obviously, you know, Anthony Bourdain was just such a huge, huge
influence. He was just a real human being.
He was.
I'm just thinking about this. So, you know, I share with you my husband was in Japan.
Yeah.
And I could be wrong. But, well, I know for sure he ate in one of the back alley bars in Tokyo where Bourdain had been. But I think he was there on the 25th because he came home on the 26th. How weird is that?
Really, really weird.
Bourdain Day, though.
Right. That is really weird. But, you know, it really is beautiful that it was something that they tried to spread throughout the world.
You know, it's an aside, but when I did my story on after Bourdain died about just mental health and in the restaurant industry, we'd also lost a local chef.
That's right.
Allegedly under similar circumstances. But I was saying, you know, we're in kitchens all the time. We talk to chefs. We're literally sometimes in the refrigerators and the pantries. We are front of the house. We're back at the house. And I just thought to myself, I've missed the story here.
Right.
You know, I know that sometimes they put on a show when we're there.
Yeah.
But I had missed all of this. So there's really like rampant addiction and people are struggling and bartenders in particular are at risk for, you know, alcoholism, and I just kind of missed all that. So it was really eye-opening for me too, and probably for you. And we're covering this all the time.
Yeah, and like you said, it's not something that's ever, you know, on display. It's not something that, you know, anybody from the outside looking in can really see. But I think that that's such an important conversation too, you know, out of Bourdain's death to talk about mental health in the industry and how important it is to make sure that you're, you know, doing the things that you need to make sure that you're healthy and strong and able to, you know, deal with all of these other influences when working in the industry. And
Imagine being, you know, a few years sober as a bartender, but always being around, like, that's your livelihood, always being around the thing that caused your addiction. I can't imagine what that's like and the self-control that must take.
Yeah.
I interviewed a chef this week who's speaking of traveling.
Yes, yes.
Chef Helena Del Pesco.
Yes.
From Larder. Yeah, we were talking about this last week. And but this week I got to speak with her, and she has worked in all kinds of kitchens, from the famed Chez Panisse, Alice Waters kitchen.
Wow.
Outside San Francisco, to a Michelin-starred place in San Sebastian in the Basque Country of Spain. And she was fascinating because she's an artist. She's a trained fine artist, actually, both undergrad and graduate degree. And so we just talked about how she segued into cooking. It sounded like cooking was always sort of part of her life, but I love the way that, you know, she did a master's thesis that entailed having 8 and 10-year-olds run a restaurant for a day. How great is that?
I've read about this. That's amazing.
And their dish was
something about a burrito.
Each of them worked with pasta in different ways.
Okay.
So one kid predictably had like a Nutella ravioli kind of dish.
And, yeah.
But she said her favorite one was a burrito ravioli.
Yes, that's what it was.
Which I think is so clever.
Oh, it is.
Isn't that great?
It says a lot about how kids' minds work too. You know, they just think of these like really clever things. And
And then she had another project, I guess, where all the foods were red, so she did an entire menu based on the color red.
That is incredible.
But I think ultimately it became a little limiting because she was working in these exhibition spaces and there were all these rules and regulations about, you know, bringing food in and what you couldn't bring in around the art. And so she, you know, gave that up and went full time to cooking.
Wow. She sounds so, so talented. We're talking about all kinds of art, theater, visual art.
It's true, yeah.
It's incredible.
Do you remember a few months ago, actually, I did a piece on, I think I called it Artsy Chefs. That
yes.
There's chefs that have these really great hobbies.
Yes.
Like Andy Gaynor, the sushi executive chef at Azumi, is he's a woodworker, mm-hmm. and he makes knives. But beautiful knives.
Yes.
Knives that you would want to own. Works of art knives.
Right.
There was, who else did I write about?
I remember.
You'll have to remind me.
The hilarious anecdote. You're probably thinking the same one of Carlos who doodles.
Carlos Rava, yeah. Right, from Clavel.
He doodles the way that he wants his plates to look.
That's right.
It's like an app on his phone.
Gorgeous little doodly, sketchy things
right.
on his phone that he does just with his finger on the phone, adding dabs of color just so he can conceive of what the plate's going to look like.
It's incredible. You found that out on a podcast.
Yeah, right? He was here to talk with us along with Lane Harlan, who also owns Clavel. And I guess maybe when we weren't recording, he showed me his doodles
because
I asked to see them. So that was really cool.
Yeah.
There's definitely a connection.
Food is such an art form, and I think, you know, to see it connect to these other mediums is really a beautiful thing.
And then in some ways the most amazing one was the chef from Alma, Enrique Limardos, who is just, I mean, he could sell his portraits. He does these, they might be charcoal portraits of famous people.
Wow.
You would know immediately who they are. They're really beautiful. Really evocative, and after, you know, working like a 12-15 hour shift, I think he doesn't really sleep. He goes home, and that's how he relaxes until 2 a.m.
Wow.
He does a lot of artists and famous composers, and he's pretty prolific, and his work is beautiful.
I'm so happy you mentioned that story. It really is such a beautiful piece, which is now online if anybody wants to check it out. And also, you know, just making these connections, like chefs really are, they have these artistic spirits and minds.
Right.
And
yeah, we called it palette to palette.
Yes.
I'm remembering
with
now.
The different spellings.
Yeah.
I love that. Very cool. And so what was your best bite this week, Jane?
You know, I'm very basic top of mind. I just had a great lunch, so I'll talk about that.
Of course.
Bird in Hand. I've actually never eaten over there.
Really?
Yeah. Bird in Hand is a partnership with the Ivy Bookshop and the folks at Artifact and AKA Woodbury Kitchen,
mm-hmm.
not AKA, but affiliated. I, you know, in the summertime, I'm just not as hungry as I am.
Sure,
that makes sense. In the cooler months. So I just had, I had tomato toast. It was slathered with this really wonderful ricotta cheese, of course, local, because that's what they're all about. Wonderful fresh tomatoes, of course, not just a regular tomato, but like tri-color tomatoes.
Oh, beautiful.
And then
talk about works of art.
Yeah, and then it had a like a squeeze of basil. It looked like pesto, but it was just pure basil, I think. Just really beautiful. Like a
sounds delicious.
A swirl on top. And yeah, it was really delicious. It needed a little salt.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. You're sitting outside. There was no salt shaker. But that's another story. I love salt.
Yes. I know you do love salt. It was hard for me to choose. We actually went to Forno before the Hippodrome last night.
Oh, yeah.
And had a beautiful, they have a really great antipasto platter.
Mm-hmm.
So lovely cheeses. There was a goat cheese on there. There were you know, the candied pecans.
Those
are so good.
Right.
Yes. And I love those because you can kind of like mix and match so many different combinations. And
I
make
love
it
them
different.
Because they're dessert, but they count as an appetizer.
Right, exactly. And they have a truffle honey that they include
Ooh.
On those boards that is just out of this world. But also, you know, that got me thinking about, because there were pickled vegetables on that platter as well. And I had a really great dish this week at Arba inside our house. They had a pickled, it was a chicken shawarma dish that had pickled onions on top of it. And it was...
Thank God pickling's
there. I know.
Yeah.
It's so good. And especially in the summertime, I feel like I've been like craving it.
Not everybody, my husband doesn't like pickled things.
Really?
Yeah, there are people that do and there are people that don't.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one or the other. Yeah. But the pickled onions really made this dish. It was, you know, a huge, huge helping of hummus. And then on top they had the chicken shawarma and the pickled onions on the top of that. And then a lot, like this huge helping of pita, which was
delicious.
It was so good. It was like the perfect lunch. But I think I'm definitely having a pickled vegetable moment.
Well, if you had a cookbook. Like
yeah.
I
oh
do,
my gosh.
Okay. I made cucumbers this week. Pickled.
Ooh.
What did I do with them? Oh, I just went to that Misty Valley farm that I raved about a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And
yes.
I just did something with every one of their vegetables.
Wow.
So the cucumbers that I bought got just pickled. I didn't even look up a recipe. It's vinegar, sugar. I guess you could put some garlic in there, some salt for a couple of hours. They can be as, you know, pickly as you want.
Yeah.
Knowing that my husband doesn't like really pickled things, I just marinated them for a few hours. But they were delicious.
You know what? I could do that. Even though I don't own a cookbook, I could do it. So I'm definitely up for the challenge. I think it's just like, you know, the summer months, you're just in the mood for a snack or whatever, just to have them with dinner or on a salad.
Yeah, just got the water bottle ready.
That's right. Well, thank you so much, Jane, for another great week, another great episode. Thanks, everyone, so much for listening. And you can pick up a copy of our July issue. It's our Crabs A to Z guide. It's on newsstands now, and you can check out our food coverage every day at BaltimoreMagazine.com.
Local Flavor Live podcast is powered by AudioStack, which provides all the tools you need to host, distribute, and monetize your podcast.